if it's a boy or a girl? It's that question expecting parents always get asked. Some are happy with whatever may be, but here's a question for you. If you could, would you choose the sex of your baby? Now, sex selection is illegal in this country, except for, in particular, medical cases. But some Australian parents are now packing their bags and heading overseas to jurisdictions which allow them to select the sex of their baby. Should that be an option that's allowed in Australia? Is the law too prohibitive here, or are we right to be cautious, given that certainly globally girl fetuses are dumped or aborted? There are well-known cases of that right around the world. Could sex selection herald a newly sanctioned form of eugenics, perhaps? That's a question that many ethicists are asking. And we want to tease out some of these issues. Joining me this morning is Professor Michael Selgalid. He's director of the Centre for Human Bioethics at Monash University. We also have on the line with us from California, Dr. Daniel Potter. Now, he's a fertility doctor with HRC Fertility, and also with is Jodie McMahon. She's an Australian mother who, after seven boys, decided it was time to make sure that the next child was a girl, and she went to California to seek the help of Dr. Potter to do that. Welcome to you all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello there.
Good morning.
And we've got Michael there in the studio in Melbourne. Michael, I'll start with you. What's the current picture here in Australia? Why is sex selection still illegal in Australia?
Yeah, well, for the most part, the use of PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, you know, as was discussed earlier in the show in Australia, is limited to, you know, testing embryos for genes that predispose them to having diseases. And that kind of testing, you know, could technically be used for other kinds of purposes, i.e., to select for positively desired characteristics. But in Australia, like in lots of other countries, you know, the use of that kind of testing is limited to screening against diseases. And there are various reasons why that's the case, why people are worried about you know, selecting for positively desired characteristics. And, you know, one of the concerns, as you mentioned, is that, you know, that raises issues about eugenics and designer babies and commodification of human reproduction and things of that nature.
And we'll explore that a little bit further with all three of you throughout this discussion. Under what circumstances is sex selection legal in Australia? Because there are select circumstances.
Yeah, well, there's some diseases that are linked to, you know, chromosomes associated with the sex or gender of the offspring. So those are called sex-linked traits or sex-linked diseases. And so there will be some cases where there's a family history of such diseases, and then there will be, you know, a case for testing embryos produced to see if, you know, they're going to be a male or a female, and if there's a risk of, you know, a disease being passed on to males in particular, then that could provide a medical reason for selecting an embryo that will be female.
Yes, okay. So that's quite a clear, specific case. Let me come to Daniel Potter. Daniel, in the US, well, you're one of the few countries, or states at least, in California, where it's legally permitted still to use pre-implantation genetic diagnosis for prenatal sex selection. Why is it legal where you are?
Well, I mean, it's a reproductive freedom issue. It's a personal freedom issue. It's a pursuit of happiness issue. You know, the technology exists, and unlike, I mean, I think that one of the big pushes against it in most countries that outside the United States is that your governments pay for fertility services, and I don't think the government should be paying for people to do elective things for, you know, personal reasons. But here in the United States, people are using their own time and their own treasure to do it. The government doesn't pay. And generally speaking, he who pays the bill makes the rules. So, you know, in terms of the ethical arguments against it, I think that they're all weak at best. I mean, you know, in terms of a slippery slope type arguments where, you know, if people do this, then pretty soon they're going to be trying to pick their hair color and eye color and all that stuff is absolutely ridiculous, and you know, anybody who knows anything about the science of these things knows it's absurd. And you know, for them to put those arguments forward is, you know, if they're informed, it's disingenuous.
I'll come to the procedures that you're doing and why you're doing it, but certainly just to pick you up there. When we look at, for example, the incidence of infanticide or foeticide amongst girl fetuses across the world, or girl children, I mean, clearly sex selection has a kind of cultural story there too that's quite disturbing. In India, in China particularly.
Yeah, and I think that in different cultures, they have gender selection for different reasons. I mean, in, you know, countries that have Sharia law, you know, women can't inherit property completely, even from their husbands. So if you want to keep the wealth in your family, you have to have a son. Otherwise, your brothers get it or their families get it. So, you know, there are a number of things that are sexist and, you know, not what we appreciate or our spouse here in the Western world that go on all over the world, but that doesn't change the technology. I mean, when you have technology and you have to have ethical people that are, you know, responsible for the technology or technology, you know, in terms of what's ethical here versus what's ethical in China. I mean, I don't know whether, you know, how much of those things are absolute. I mean, I think infanticide is obviously just a horrible failure. And for people to do that, I mean, people do that in poor countries when they can't feed their children. They do it, for a variety of reasons. But it is abysmal. But in the Western world, the majority of people doing gender selection are doing it to have girls, far and away.
So tell us about that, because you're very passionate about what you do and the service that you provide. What are the reasons, and in increasing numbers, I gather, that couples come to you or parents come to you saying that they want to select the sex of their child?
Well, I mean, primarily, you know, you have women driving this who have two or three or sometimes more boys and only want to have one more pregnancy, but really, you know, want to have a girl, and, you know, will feel that, you know, their life is like something that they've always wanted to do in their life. At the end of their life, if they haven't had a girl, they'll feel like they've missed out on something, or they haven't achieved everything they wanted to achieve. And so we have the technology to make that happen. So, you know, a lot of people that are against people using this technology are perfectly in favor of people trying things that don't work, like diets and, you know, calendars and timing and all this other stuff that doesn't work. I mean, they're fine with people trying to influence the gender. It's just that they don't like the certainty of this technology. And, you know, it's really people, it should be the woman's individual decision whether to get pregnant or not, whether to have a boy or a girl. You know, in your country, in Australia, a woman could terminate a pregnancy for any reason she wants, including the gender. But, you know, you guys get, you know, a little sticky about people deciding which embryo to put back based on gender, to the point where you have someone that's doing PGD for whatever indication, and they won't tell them what the gender is. So you have a situation where, you know, adults have information about the gender of the embryo, but they can't share that information with the consumer or the patient because they don't trust the consumer or the patient with that information or to have that information to make a decision.
It's definitely a consumer-led movement here. Let me bring in our next guest, Jodie McMahon. Jodie, you were one of those mothers who had a lot of boys, seven boys, in fact. Tell us about the pull to have a girl for you.
Well, it was pretty strong, and, like, you know, after that many boys, like, it did become a bit funny, really. Like, how many can you have of the one sex? It was pretty strong, and it did sort of continue over a few years until we, you know, found Dr. Potter. So that's sort of
And I think you've got a fax machine that's just probably dialed you in the middle of this conversation.
I've got a fax machine trying to work.
Can we get that sorted out, or
yes,
is it finished?
I just went and sorted that, sorry.
Beautiful. So I mean, you had seven boys, you wanted a girl, and you made this trip at enormous expense to yourself, didn't you?
Yes, it wasn't cheap, and we're not, you know, we're just a normal family. Andrew and I both run our own businesses, so like we had to save up to do it. Like we just couldn't, you know, pull the money from just wherever. Like we saved for a few years so we could we could make the journey and try and, you know, I guess fill our dreams of having a daughter.
Do you mind if I ask how much you had to save in order to undergo the procedure?
Probably, like, if I always like to round it up so I don't, you know, people don't underestimate things, but probably about 50, I think, by the time we travelled and you know, we did acupuncture and a few other sort of things. So by the time you add all that kind of thing, it does add up.
How did you feel about not being able to have access to sex selection in Australia and having to travel to the US for it?
Well, at first I was, because we originally did have access to it, and I had taken the steps to do it here in Australia with one of the Sydney clinics, and then all of a sudden we just heard on the news, bang, can't use it. So that was just devastating. Like, because we had planned to do it that way, and I had made contact with a clinic and stuff like that. So that sort of didn't really go down well. So then, you know, I burred up a bit and like, right, we'll go elsewhere, basically. So then we sort of started. I started looking, obviously, overseas because that was our only option. And then we found the California clinic where Dr. Potter was. So.
And the outcome for you was?
Well, we had Addison. That was our outcome. And we were quite lucky. Like, we still, I mean, people that do IVF would know the stress. And I know a lot of people say, well, it's not counted that I had the stress because I had other children. But it was a very stressful and emotional ride. And it wasn't just easy going. It wasn't, we just went over there, we got our eggs and we, you know, got our embryo and we whacked it in and it worked. Like we had, you know, we didn't get as many eggs as we thought and so we do had a few little roller coaster rides, and in the end I assume luck it was meant to be, and we did have a successful healthy pregnancy, and we had Addison as our result.
And then you went back for more.
Well, we ended up with, out of three eggs, we ended up with, like, Addison and a little frozen embryo who is now Evie.
Evie, although she had a different name originally,
yeah,
I think.
She did have a different name for a while.
So this is a massive expense. You have a family of seven children already, and then eight, and then nine, money that you could definitely use on the existing seven children. So this was a very distinct pull, it seems to me. How do you view, though, the ethical conundrums around this? Because people do have legitimate ethical concerns around the motives for people to utilise sex selection procedures.
Yeah, they do have their, like their, you know, they don't like it. And I find a lot of people that don't, it doesn't bother them. They won't admit it. They won't go yes or no either way. They'll just sit in a neutral corner and not stick up for either sort of side. The people that just don't like it are very vocal, so they're the people that you will hear. And, you know, like I guess.
So
like,
did you hear from those people? Like,
yeah,
what
I guess,
about family or friends or colleagues?
I was lucky. I didn't have any family that I know of that has said to me, no, this is wrong, you should not be doing this, blah, blah, blah. I had a lot of support from my family, which is good, which, I mean, like, I have got to the age where, you know, this is my decision and our family's decision. I don't really care what other people think. But there was a point where I did not want to tell people because I didn't want people going, oh, you should be happy with what you've got. You got your healthy boys. And that is true. We did have a healthy family and healthy boys, but there was that little piece missing. And I could have continued quite happily in life with that little piece missing. I wasn't a person that would have dwelled on that, but I did have the opportunity and I wanted to see, well, give it one shot and see if it works. If it doesn't work, I knew we had done. We had tried, and so then we would have been happy. We tried, it failed, let's move on. But the people that that do sort of, I guess, carry on a bit, I just don't think their arguments are strong enough.
So Michael Selgalid from Monash University, as a bioethicist, do you think some of the arguments are valid? That really take this to task? I mean, our Dr. Daniel Potter has mentioned, well, yes, it might happen in India and China, some of the concerns around the use of sex selection or infanticide, but it wouldn't necessarily be the case in the West. Should we be genuinely concerned about a slippery slope here?
Yeah, well, you know, the ethics of sex selection in particular largely turn on, you know, what is the motivation for the sex selection. So there might be some cases where it would be ethically problematic. So if parents want to choose one sex rather than the other because they think, you know, the one sex is better than the other, well, then that involves, you know, bias and prejudice and discrimination and so on. And that's not what's going on in the case of choosing one sex over the other in the case of family balancing. So there might
be, as in Jody's case.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's important to consider. What is the motivation for sex selection in any given case? Another thing to take into account ethically is, you know, what are the consequences of these practices going to be? So if it's a very widespread thing, then there could be adverse consequences, i.e. in the proportion of, you know, males and females in society. If it's not such a widespread thing, then there wouldn't be that kind of consequence. And we should also take into account the consequence of, you know, the use of medical technology and medical personnel on the healthcare system and, you know, the draining away of resources from what might arguably considered to be, you know, more important purposes, i.e. the use of medical resources and personnel for, you know, the treatment and prevention of disease and alleviation of suffering thereby.
So it's a question of priorities.
Yeah. Now, as far as the, you know, what should be appropriate in a country like Australia, so there's not the same kind of gender issues in culture or at least they're not as widespread in Australia as they are in countries like India and China, where there's quite, you know, strong pressure on families to, you know, favor or choose one sex over the other. So that means that a lot of the use of this technology wouldn't be based on the more problematic kind of motivation. And also the use of this technology for this kind of purpose is not likely to be so widespread. So we don't need to worry as much about the adverse consequences, you know, being, you know, having a lot more men than women or vice versa.
Okay. Dr. Daniel Potter, back to you in the US. Let's come to some of these issues. I gather your own American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists Committee on Ethics opposes your profession meeting requests for sex selection for personal and family reasons. How do you then connect with their arguments in your own practice as a leading fertility doctor?
Well, I mean, first of all, let me say that, you know, I really agree with pretty much everything that the professor just said, and it was well said, you know. But I think that in the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, unfortunately, has increasingly become an obsolete politically motivated organization, and so it's politically correct to be against gender selection because it is seen as sexist because the assumption is that people are using it to discriminate against women. And, you know, it's kind of, I just find it ironic that that's the argument they're using, but that's not really the motivation for the people that want it. And in fact, they're discriminating against women and inhibiting their reproductive freedom by doing this. And so, you know, the American College of Obstetricians, again, they make the argument that you could terminate an 18-week-old fetus that's fully formed and, nearly ready to live outside the womb just for any reason at all. It's on a whim. But you know, it's really just wrong to use the, you know, the gender of an embryo to decide which one to put back. Now,
aren't you confusing those two? One is about reproductive choice to carry a child to term, a fetus to term. The other is about whether or not we should have the right to select the sex of a child, which has a whole other social story and social dimension to it.
No, I mean, it really depends on the ideological bias of the person who's making the argument. So if you start with the conclusion that you're against sex selection, which is what these people do, then you start working back and trying to form your argument to assemble facts that support it, you end up with an intellectually inconsistent position, which is not, I'm not confusing anything. I mean, they don't question the motive of a woman terminating an 18-week fetus. They don't wonder, like, what, is she doing it for gender? Or is she doing it because she doesn't want to get pregnant? Is she in an abusive relationship? I mean, they don't ask questions. There's no questions. There's an assumption that the person is going to use that technology in an ethical way and in a way that's appropriate for that individual purpose, for that individual person. So we're giving them the dignity to make these decisions for themselves, and I think that's appropriate, okay? Now, when it comes to this issue, that same assumption now is that you're going to use this technology to do something that I think is wrong, and you know, I don't want you to do something with your life that I disagree with. So,
but what about concerns about the new eugenics, though? Because this is, we are social beings. We exist in a social context.
Well, I mean, the true science behind this process is it's a very inefficient process, and so the technology necessary to determine the chromosomal makeup of the embryo and know all 24 chromosomes has only been existent. I mean, we did the very first cases in 2008 at our center, And, you know, over the next few years, we did a handful of cases in 2009 and then fairly widespread use of it in 2010. And it's only now that we have enough data where we can look and see how truly inefficient this process is. So if you have a 35-year-old woman, maybe one embryo in four is going to be genetically normal, and the other embryos are all unusable because they have the wrong number of chromosomes. So so if you started off with 10 embryos, you're going to end up with 2.5 that are potentially normal. And then if you say, okay, half of them have to be a certain gender, now it's down to like one embryo. Now
we're losing. Unfortunately, we're losing your line, which is really getting crackly on us. And we're racing towards the head of the clock, and I hate to interrupt like this, but we were getting very crackly. I think you've all raised some very important issues, and Jody McMahon particularly, thank you for joining us to share your experiences. Daniel Potter, thank you for joining us on the line from California.
My pleasure.
Great to have you. And Professor Michael Salgelid, thank you too for joining us from there in Melbourne via Monash University.
Yep. Thank you, Natasha. It was a pleasure.